Okay, now the slightly less funny stuff. Now I'm going to talk about, this is going to do an intro to FIPS 140. So especially for the newbies, this is the important one. We're going to go through the program. I'm going to talk about how you do the process, what the steps are in the program, a little bit of the historical nature. And please feel free to stop me anytime. I like the fact at the end there we got very interactive. We've got 2 hours. And if I don't get to the very end of this talk, I'd rather, if I'm answering people's questions and helping you understand the process better, that's more important than getting to the last slide. So please feel free to stop me at any time, and we'll get going. Okay, first of all, a little bit of language. Everyone just refers to FIPS 140 as FIPS. And I've heard of people also dream up variations of what the acronym actually means. It's Federal Information Processing Standard, and there's a whole bunch of them. There are hundreds of them. FIPS 140-2 just happens to be the one we use for our cryptographic module security requirements. So there's FIPS standards for how much a kilo weighs, how much a pound weighs, how long a meter and a yard are. This is the one about crypto. They're mandatory to the federal government. They are not mandatory to the states, but they're highly recommended and often used, and Canada recommends them. So, by the way, FIPS 140 is a joint program. It's not just an American thing. So many people say that, but it's not true. So, and then also, a lot of non-governmental agencies adopt FIPS standards. So, for example, PCI and a lot of banking requires level 3 for hardware security modules used for credit card transactions. So FIPS is used both in and out of the government. The main drive for government customers is FISMA. In 2002, George W. Bush put out FISMA, and basically the most important thing about it is there used to be waivers for FIPS 140. As of 2002, there were no longer any waivers. You have to meet FIPS 140-2 if you're using cryptography for any purpose. For unclassified data in the U.S. government. So, it's applicable to all federal agencies that use cryptography to protect sensitive information, including voice. It should be used in designing and implementing cryptographic modules that federal departments and agencies that operate under them use. So, this also includes things like protecting communications and payroll data and personnel data. Now, of course, it's unfortunately for some of the stuff we've heard in the news, it's not always used correctly, which is, again, why the security policy is important. It talks about how to use the modules, and then, of course, the module doesn't do anything except encrypt data. Your security is a bigger subject. We're not going to cover that today, but that's really the bigger issue is security. Cryptography is just a tool you use to create security. And the most important thing is, The standard precludes the use of unvalidated cryptography anywhere in the U.S. government. If you're using unvalidated cryptography, it's considered plain text. And while it's never happened, the punishment on the books for that is to lose your funding. So any federal department that does encryption on non-FIPS 140 validated devices could, in fact, lose their funding. But it's never happened yet. Okay, and I actually beat that. It's considered no, unvalidated cryptography is considered no protection. Okay, so now we know the government needs to use cryptography that's validated. We know a lot of other industries want to use validated cryptography. This is in some ways a CYA thing. You understand that banks and other commercial industries started using FIPS 140 because they're saying, hey, look, I'm having an independent third party validate this protection I'm using on my data. It covers me. So it's a good thing. And it's one of the reasons it's becoming more popular. So let's talk about the program. Okay, the CMVP, Cryptographic Module Validation Program, is a joint program. It's not just US. A lot of people say, oh, it's a US thing only with, you know, It's always been a joint program between the U.S. and Canada. In fact, when we look at the logo, I'll show you kind of the proof of that. But the thing is, CMVP is a joint program, and it's now being accepted in many more countries than just the U.S. The laboratories that, okay, the government found out or figured out a bunch of years ago that they didn't have the resource to do all this testing. But they wanted to make sure that there was repeatable quality testing available for cryptographic modules. So they developed this tiered system, which we use today, which is you go to an accredited laboratory. The laboratory works with you, does your testing. When they feel that you've met all the requirements, they produce a report, and they combine the report and other evidence together, and they send it to the CMVP, who reviews that, asks questions, makes comments until they are satisfied that the module actually meets requirements, and then they issue the certificate. ISO 17025 and U.S. Handbook 150-17 are the tools used to accredit the labs. Those are the standards manuals for the lab. And then the U.S. NAVLAP program then tests and certifies the lab as an IT security testing laboratory. And so when you go to the lab, understand they are accredited. They do get tested. Every 2 years, the lab is very deeply audited. And they actually send an auditor out to do verbal testing of the test engineers. So you actually sit at a table, and they just start saying, okay, you know, what about this? What about this? How do you meet this requirement? So the labs are tested, and every single submission that a lab makes with a customer's product is also considered another test of competence. They are testing both the module and the laboratory. So the laboratories are pretty well checked out. You're going to find out that your laboratory is going to be a competent bunch of people who understands the standard better than anybody else, or as well as the CMVP. To prevent conflict of interest, the labs are not allowed to do any consulting while they do your module validation. Now, differing from common criteria, if you're familiar with that, common criteria, they are allowed to put up a wall and have a consulting team and an evaluation team. That's not permitted under FIPS. The only two things that are permitted under FIPS 140 that the lab do for you as part of your work is they can create the security policy from your documents, not supplying any intellectual property of their own, and they can produce the finite state model, again, from your documents, not putting in any intellectual property of their own. The rest of it, if you want, what some customers do is there are consulting companies, or they'll hire one lab as a consultant and one lab as their test lab. I've seen both done. It's not always necessary, but especially if you're doing a first time through on something really complicated, it might not be a bad idea. The other thing is FIPS 140 is a conformance test. It's not an evaluation. The old common criteria, if you're familiar with, like EAL4, was an evaluation. There were certain open-ended items that the lab could put as much resource as they felt necessary onto something and take as much time as they felt necessary. FIPS 140-2, the requirements are strict. As soon as you meet them, you're done. So FIPS 140 is a conformance test, and if you meet all of the requirements, you're validated. Now notice that may be red, white, and blue, and there may be white stars and red and white and blue trim, but the little red in the middle of that is the Canadian maple leaf. And that's showing Canada's involvement in FIPS 140, and they have been since the very beginning. I love it the way people are staring at it like they've never seen that before. Okay, this is the process, and this is really what we're going to talk about. Europe starts up here with you. You go find a lab, and you start working with the lab. If there are questions, and this is where we tend to add new things to the implementation guidance, if there are any questions, the lab goes to NIST and CSE, and they figure out how to solve those issues. And then once the methodology is fixed, if there any need for any adjustments or implementation guidance updates, when they're all done testing, you then create a report and all the evidence, which is then sent over to NIST. They review all that a certificate if they agree that you've met all the requirements, and you go on to the list of validated modules. The truth is, there's probably about 100 back and forth arrows here, 100 back and forth arrows here, maybe a dozen here. It's never quite so clean and pretty, but it works, and the program has been in place for a number of years. There's over 2,000 validated modules, and the program goes on. Okay, so now what is a cryptographic module? The module is defined by its security functionality, and we'll talk about approved functions in a minute, and it's also defined by its boundary. Again, for those of you who are new, and even for those of you who are not, defining the cryptographic boundary may be the single most important thing you do in the definition of your module, because it will affect so many other things, especially if you make changes in parts of your product, what will require revalidation or not, what requires testing, how the testing is performed. All of these things come into it. Choosing your boundary is extremely critical. You can have modules embodied in hardware, software, firmware, or a hybrid combination of them. And the vast majority of modules are software. In fact, the most common module, I'm sure most of you are aware of, OpenSSL, which is a software module at level one. There are four levels, we'll talk about that later. That is probably the most commonly used module anywhere for doing crypto. It's the one most commonly used for doing web crypto and TLS or SSL for when you do web shopping. A lot of companies just embed it into their own code and use it as their crypto. It's one of the shortest ways. Since OpenSSL has been validated on so many platforms, it's one of the quickest ways to get validated crypto into your product. Yes. When we talk about security functionality, you know, these are the typical, you know, we've got symmetric key, AES, asymmetric key, elliptic curve and RSA, hashing, SHA, message authentication. So these are the cryptographically enhanced hashes. Random number generators, which of course we're spending a tremendous amount of time on this year because they seem to have become the center of everything, and key management. Key management is the one that's probably most often ignored and often the worst handled. Then we'll talk about the physical. You have to define a physical boundary for your module that may or may not be coincident with the logical boundary. For example, at level one, where you have a software module, the physical boundary is typically the computer that it runs on. But the module may only be the blob of code that actually runs your crypto. So the thing is, the physical and logical boundaries can be different. The physical boundary must be contiguous, typically a hard case. You can have nested cryptographic modules, you know, kind of like, you know, Russian dolls. But the logical boundary defines the boundary of the software component. So for example, if I have a computer that's a web server that uses OpenSSL to do TLS, the logical boundary is the blob of code that is the OpenSSL executable, and the hardware boundary, the physical boundary, is the boundary of the case of the computer that it runs on. And if level one, that's not too critical. When we start talking about the higher levels with physical security, that becomes more and more important. Okay, so what are the main objectives you're trying to achieve with a cryptographic module? You want to have a group of correctly implemented, approved functions that are used for protecting data. So that's your cryptography. You want to protect the module from unauthorized use. So at levels above level one, there's going to be some authentication requirement to do certain functions on the module. Level one, no additional requirements are put on. You want to prevent unauthorized disclosure of the secrets. You don't want, because obviously if your keys get exposed, then you're not protecting anything anymore because people could just decrypt what you've encrypted. So you want to protect unauthorized disclosure, and that's where the whole key management and access control. And then you want to prevent, and this is one, there's a particular requirement that we'll get to for the integrity of the module. You want to protect that from unauthorized and undetected modification. So obviously you don't want someone to be able to hack into your module and put a little extra blob of code in there that transmits out your keys every time you put them in. So an integrity test is part of the self-test requirement, and we'll get to that in just a few minutes. We also want to prevent the unauthorized modification, substitution, insertion, and deletion of keys and other secrets. By the way, the term CSP, critical security parameter, that's kind of the general term used for saying anything that's important, it's a secret, may or may not be a key, but it's going to be something that's important to the security function of the module. You want to make sure they can't be modified, deleted, added, changed without your knowing about them. We want to provide indications of the operational state. Is it working? Is it working correctly? And we want to make sure that it functions properly when it's in the approved mode of operation. Note, this is one of the things that is not terribly clear in the standard, but there are a lot of people who will produce a cryptographic module that have an approved mode when you're running in full compliance, and then they sometimes will drop out of approved mode, add algorithms that are not approved. You know, some people still like using Blowfish for things. No idea why, but, or you may have to do that for some legacy. And the only, one of the important requirements are is that you can't share those secrets. Your CSPs can't be shared between approved and non-approved mode. So there are requirements there you're gonna have to deal with if you do have a non-approved mode. Okay, so that's a little bit of background, you know, what the standard is, what the purpose is, what its whole reason is. Now let's start talking about the standard itself and go into the process. Back in 1982, in the dim history of all this stuff, there was Federal Standard 1027. It was really a spec for line encryptors used for telephone lines, and if any of you remember the Stu-3 telephone, that's what that was all about. Then what happened is the government recognized that cryptography was going to become important in the non-classified part of the world, that commercially crypto was going to be important, that the government was going to need to use it in places that weren't normally thought of as secret. You know, no one at that point, no one had envisioned the internet, no one thought about shopping at Amazon, but people were starting to think about those kind of things, that you were going to need to be able to protect data in the public world. So they took Fed Standard 1027 and made it a placeholder and called it FIPS 140. There were no validations against it. It just held the place while FIPS 140-1 was being written. And that started in about 1983. It took 11 years. But by 1994, FIPS 140-1 had been written. It had gone through the Federal Register process. It had been adjusted to meet the comments, and it was released and put in place as the standard. It was set up that it was going to be reviewed and renewed every 5 years. So FIPS 140-2 came out pretty much on schedule in 2001, because in 1999, the review started. FIPS 140-2 was an update of FIPS 140-1. It again had to go through the Federal Register process, public comments, and in 2001, FIPS 140-2 came out. And then. Well, it's now 2015 and three quarters, and we're still on Dash 2. And there had been a Dash 3 effort. I've actually went in and cleaned a few of the slides out about that. The NIST effort to do Dash 3 got to the point of releasing a copy for public comment that was so buried under the comments that the whole effort kind of collapsed. And that's as close as I can come to an official position. I don't know if there is one. In the meanwhile, back in 2006, several people, including people from the CMVP, started working on an ISO version of FIPS 140, which is 197.90. And right now, that's been announced as there was a release in 2006, there was a second updated edition in 2012, and that's now been released through the Federal Register as a candidate to replace Dash 2 and become, whether what they're going to call it, whether it's Dash 3 or not, I don't know, but that is in the works. Sir. It may be. My slide might be back.
Yours is correct. That was put on the website for NIST that it should be the 2012 edition, but it's the 2014 edition. It was actually in the Federal Register.
Oops.
Yep.
I don't know what that effect that's going to have in the long run, but I think the expectation is 197.90. I forgot the number. For the publication that's the derived test requirements.
24759.
Thank you, sir. 24759. Leave it to Chris. They're going to be, in the long run, the ones that we use as the replacement for FIPS. They are largely the same. Probably the biggest difference is they have a crypto-sized hole cut in them so that each country can plug in their own algorithms. Korea, Japan, and a number of other countries have their own sets of algorithms. They sometimes allow ours, sometimes don't. We don't allow theirs. So the thing is, 197.90 will cover everything but the crypto algorithms, and each country will slot in their own little annex with their approved functions. Really no different than FIPS 140 is, except this is kind of the way it's being built from the start, because in FIPS 140, you go to the annex with the approved functions. There, it's been designed from the beginning to work that way. So this is pretty much the history, and really 197.90 is the likely scenario going forward. Now, at least today, this is going to change a little bit once we go to 197.90, but even if everything goes as quickly as possible, that's still probably over a year out. I'm guessing. I have no knowledge exactly of the dates, but if I look at transitions from the past, that's probably about what we're going to expect. Right now, there is the standard. It is the basic document. It has all the assertions and requirements. Read it once. Keep it under your pillow for nights you can't sleep. It is not going to be your everyday, daily working document. The annexes talk about, okay, Annex A is the one that's very important right now. It's going to be the approved security functions, but there's also Special Publication 800-131A, which talks about sunsetting and replacement of algorithms. So really, between Annex A and SP-131A, that's where you dig up your approved functions. And so for right now, that's AES, RSA. Apparently, they just put 4Kbit back in, so you can use 2/2048, 3072, or 4096. EC is currently with the 256, 384-bit NIST approved curves. SHA-1's pretty much gone. SHA-256 up and SHA-3 are going to be good. Those are your basic crypto algorithms. They're all the different combinations of key handling and key generation that also use these algorithms that get added. I won't go into all the other numbers. Annex C is approved random number generators. Annex B is currently empty because it's approved protection profiles. There really has been a divorce between common criteria requirements and FIPS requirements. So it used to be that if you were going for a software-only module level 2, you could reference a common criteria protection profile. That's not really true anymore, or I guess it's still there. I don't think anyone does it anymore. So I don't know what that's one that's so unusual it doesn't even bear any more time. Random number generators, that's really become, again, when we get to the discussion of the implementation guidance, you really want to look in the SP-890 series for that stuff. And then Appendix D is approved key establishment techniques. And again, that's one that's also gained kind of life of its own. The next document, whether this is 197.90 in the future or FIPS 140-2 right now, is the derived test requirements, and that is your everyday working document. And we'll get into great detail on how to read the DTR later, but the derived test requirements basically has each assertion, the vendor evidence requirement, and the lab test requirement right together for each assertion. That is your everyday working document for FIPS 140. The other one that especially lately seems to be the one that we need to look at the most is the implementation guidance. The implementation guidance document is, as said before, the document that covers all the cases that weren't covered by the standard when it was originally written. It covers all the clarification on stuff that, because of modern development, made requirements that used to be pretty clear now pretty unclear. And then also, and unfortunately, as was stated by the gentleman over here, it in some cases adds requirements that, now technically that's not supposed to happen, but unfortunately, as some new things occur that there was no coverage for in the past and you have to cover them, it actually becomes a new addition to the standard, which again, that was never envisioned happening, but you had to cover stuff some way. So the IG, which technically by law can only clarify, does in fact amend the standard in some ways. There's also been some question for 197.90 about IG, because people tend to think that the IG is really the replacement for the DTR, and it's not. So they think that the IG is the only important document to look at the requirements. And when we go to 197.90, it should be reset to zero. It should start as a blank document and then slowly have things added as clarification is needed. So if we do switch to 197.90, the IG will probably go back to a blank document. Right now, the IG for FIPS 140-2 is longer than the standard. Okay, more about the standard itself. It's divided into 11 functional areas. Each area, when you submit and the module is tested, is awarded a security level between 1 and 4, 1 being the lowest, 4 being the highest. The module is also awarded an overall level, and that's usually the one that everyone identifies a module with. It's a level 2 module. Well, a level 2 module could have 10 sections at level 4 and one section at level 2, and that's a level 2 module. The overall level is the lowest you score in any of the 11 sections. So most of the time, people tend to go straight down, you know, straight party line voting. You go for level 2 at all. You know, if you want a level 2, you go for level 2 at everything. There are some customers that have gotten a bit more sophisticated, one of them being the U.S. Post Office. And they have a requirement for either small postal meters used in small businesses or big postal meters that are used on the internet, like mainframes that sell like epost.com and stuff like that, where you can actually print indicia on your envelope. So you're basically printing money. So they have a higher requirement for that. So they actually go through and say each of the 11 categories what they want, what number they want you to meet. And so they're unusual. There are some other organizations that do that. For the most part, if they do have a requirement besides just being FIPS 140 validated, they're also going to attach a single overall number level as the requirement. Okay, so here are the areas. So I'm going to kind of quickly go through what they're called, and then we'll go through each of the 11 areas in a little more detail. There's the specification. It's basically just what it is, what it does. Ports and interfaces, all the gazintas and gozoutas. Roles, services, and authentication. Roles being users, services being what it does for you, and authentication, if required, level 1, there is no, authentication is implicit. At levels 2, 3, and 4, authentication is required, and we'll talk about the requirements. The finite state model is an operational view. Old hardware guys tend to be much more comfortable with this, but it's basically you have to be able to look at your module as a state machine and define it and draw it as such and show all the transitions. It's an unusual way of looking at it. I think that requirement gets dropped in 197.90. It's It's useful to some people as a way of looking at the module's functionality. Most people just hate having to do that diagram and the transition table, but it is a requirement. Physical security, we'll get into, that levels 2, 3, and 4, physical security is required. And at level 4, it's based, at level 2, it's simple, it's blocking the vents, adding pick-proof, you know, pick-resistant locks and tamper seals, as Chris mentioned before. At level 4, basically the lab, it's almost at an evaluation level. It's no holds barred. The lab can use anything they want to attempt to break in, and if they're successful, you fail. Operational environment is really dealing with your base OS and whether it's modifiable or not. And then cryptographic key management, how you handle, create, what's the life cycle of your keys. Moving on, there's also EMI, EMC. Again, this is a requirement most people think's kind of dumb and don't understand. You have to get an FCC type acceptance on your module at levels 2. Well, you have to have it at all. It has to be on the computer at level 1 and on the module at levels 2, 3, and 4. This was originally done because they wanted to address Tempest in some way, but when FIPS 140 came out, Tempest was all classified. So the only way that a requirement for EMC, EMI could be expressed was in terms of the FCC requirements. So that's why that reads that way. Self-tests is probably the area that affects everybody when you do your first module, because nobody does self-tests that meet the FIPS 140-2 requirements unless they're told to. So if this is one of those real cases that if you go build your module and then try to back it into FIPS 140, you are going to suffer because you're going to have to create all these known answer, all these tests of each of the approved functions, and they are going to have to run before the module can go into service. If you build these in and set it up and all the testing pieces that need to go with it as part of your original design, they go in pretty easily. If you try to back them in afterwards, it's usually pretty painful. We'll get in much more into self-test later. Design assurance is kind of the same sort of stuff you apply for any high-quality development process. How you manage your code, how you manage your versions, how you manage your manufacturing, your storage, your shipping. The requirements go up, you know, to the point where at level 4, they actually want to see that your manufacturing line is secure and that, you know, no, that any old person can't just walk out onto the manufacturing floor. You know, at level 1, it's basically saying that you want to be able to deliver the module in a way that the integrity can be verified. There is the last section is mitigation of other attacks. This is an optional section. If you do things that exceed the requirements, you can get credit for it. You can claim it, and the lab needs to test it or verify it about at the level of your over, you know, you'd want to verify that at the same overall level as your module. But for example, a good example of a mitigation of their attack is if you do blinding on RSA so that people can't do a timing attack on it, that's not required anywhere. But if you do that, you can claim it and get credit for it. And the lab would have to prove it to show that, you know, your RSA operations are constant time, but then you can claim it and it'll go on your certificate. So very few people use it, but it's always been there. All right, this is an eye test. It's a page out of the standard, and this table is basically showing each of the 11 categories and each of the 4 levels and what the requirement is. And if you'll notice, some of those categories don't change all the way across. So the module specification is constant. The requirement for the finite state model is constant. Certain aspects of key management are constant. Self-tests are constant. Whether you do level 1 or level 4, they're typically assigned at the overall level of the module. But the requirement is pretty much the same at all levels. On the other hand, we'll get into this for physical security, the requirement is quite different at each level. And for things like roles and services, especially authentication, they vary at different levels. So this is just kind of an overview and an eye test, but we'll go into the details farther down. Okay, so the module specification. You got to make sure that the boundaries are described in the security policy. The layout of the security policy is defined in the standard, what needs to be in there. And so, but very important things you got to make sure that you state in the security policy are the boundaries, because again, those are very, very important. There are a lot of other things, but in the module specification, all these other sections tend to feed back into it. So those are kind of the only one, the boundaries weren't covered in other sections, but almost all of these other sections I'm going to go through, you'll see that they have requirements that feed back in to that module specification and usually end up in the security policy. For example, ports and interfaces, all entry and exit points must be defined in the module specification. It's defined as there are four distinct types: data in and out, control in, status out. And so you have to identify those. Optionally, you can have a power interface. Some modules are battery powered. They don't have an external power interface. You may have a key loader. Some people do that at higher levels where you actually bring in one of the little, looks like a calculator with a cord. You plug it in for doing key entry. Again, very rare, but it can be specified. You can have other, and everything can get modeled into one of these ports. They can be physically separate, and at level 3 and level 4, that's a requirement, but they can still be, for example, on the same pins. They just have to be different port numbers. For a level 1 module, it can be all implicit. Okay, roles, services, and authentication. Again, all this has to go into the module specification in the security policy. You need to define and state the authorized roles. There is a minimal requirement that you have to have a user role and a crypto officer role. And at level 1, again, software modules, the simplest, they can have all the same functions available to them. At level 2 and above, you have to actually separate them. You can have a maintenance role. That's an optional, and that's especially if you have a module that is repairable where you want to open the lid and allow it to function with the lid open while somebody's working on it. There are requirements that you have to erase all the keys when you open the lid, but it can be fully functional while the maintainer is doing their job. You can also have all sorts of, you can have as many roles as you want. I've done a software module for a company when I was working for a lab that had about 50 different administrator roles, because each administrator role was only given a very small subset of functions. So they weren't considered the crypto officer, but they were an administrator. So in fact, you can have as many roles as you want. There's no limit to that. But you have to have minimally the user and crypto officer roles. Authentication is also one of the requirements. At level 1, it can be implicit. At level 2, it's a role-based authentication. I'm an administrator and I have a password. At level 3 and 4, they have to be identity-based. So I can log in as Steve as an administrator with a password and I get administrative privileges. But I could also log in as Steve as a user and get only user privileges. So at levels 3 and 4, it's identity-based and a role is assigned to it, as opposed to logging in as the role. And that's the access control. Level 1, no access control required. At level 2, it's role-based. At level 3, it's identity-based. And level 4. The finite state model, again, this is an old concept, and people who are most comfortable with it are old hardware engineers, because that's the way back in the days before microprocessors, and we just did it all in code. We actually had to work our way through stuff as state machines. But the most important part is, as it reflects to the current requirements and how you have to implement your module, is a module may only be in one state at one time. Therefore, you can't be doing crypto while entering keys. Even if you have a software module running on a multi-threaded multitasking processor, you may have to block stuff because you can't be doing more than one, the module can't be doing more than one thing at a time. Now, this may not be very modern, and it may not be very typical anymore, but that's still a requirement, and you have to be able to show that. The most important things are that you show all the operational and error states, and you provide the appropriate transitioning. So, for example, this is a very simple, but in fact, this is a very simple top-level state diagram. On the other hand, I've seen modules with a state diagram no more complicated than that. There is a mistake in this, and I leave it there just to point it out, is that if you'll notice, the power-up self-test has an exit to fatal error. Well, in fact, since there's certain tests required continuously at all times or conditionally, depending on what function you're doing, every single state should have an exit to that error state. If an error is detected of a certain category while you are doing your conditional or continuous tests, you must exit to the error state showing the module is not operational. Now again, differing in 197.90, you'll be allowed both lazy test and lazy fail. That, for example, if your random number generator fails, you'll still be able to do crypto, you just won't be able to generate keys. Under FIPS 140-2, if any function in the module fails at all, the whole module has to shut down. So that's one difference I cite between the two versions of the standard, two standards. But for right now, since we're under dash two, any specified required test fails, the whole module must shut down, go into an error state, and say, I'm dead. And that's the status reporting part. So that's the process. Notice each state has a labeled transition between the state. You can't have states go transitions back and forth between states. And then what you do after that is you create a state transition table saying, naming each transition, where it starts, where it ends, what's the reason, what's the input and output, and what's the status. And so that diagram and that table are currently required for all FIPS 140-2 validations. And it's probably, again, one of the things that you definitely wouldn't have done unless you were developing for FIPS 140. So it's something you have to become familiar with. Okay. Now there are different types of modules. You can have a single chip module, and probably I can now hold one of these up because of what happened last Christmas season. We all have single chip cryptographic modules, or pretty much all of us have them in our pockets because we all now have chip cards. These are probably the best example of a single chip module. Multi-chip modules. And that's everything from your adapter card, small internal HSMs, cryptographic accelerator cards, USB encrypting thumb drives, because they almost always have two chips. They have the controller that does all the encryption, and they have a big old flash that does all the storage. So that's why they're typically not one chip, because the thumb drive's the one they want a lot of capacity, so the memory gets kicked out to another chip. So those are multi-chip modules. But they're embedded. They don't have in fact, there's two kinds of multi-chip modules. There's embedded and there's standalone. The embedded module is put inside something else. The USB is kind of one of the weird ones because they don't really function laying on the table, but they're usually not hidden inside something. Normally, a card is a multi-chip embedded, as where a computer will be a multi-chip standalone, or an HSM, or those sort of things. Hardware security module, for people not familiar with the term. So those are your different kinds of modules. The most common for multi-chip, yeah, are computers, routers, networking equipment. That happens to be my particular place in the world right now. Secure radios. Those are all multi-chip standalones. And again, another one of these iChart tables. It's showing that as your security goes from level 1 to level 4 and your different type of embodiment changes, whether it's There's a requirement for all levels, single chip, multi-chip embedded, and multi-chip standalone. Your physical security requirements vary. So at level one, there is no real security requirement as such. There's only the requirement that you build it using commercial parts, you know, well-known, you know, your chips are made by known vendors, they're traceable, they're real companies. At level two, your primary requirement is for tamper evidence that you can tell after the fact during audit the module has been broken into. So the most common thing used at level two are the stickers. And so the thing about your sticker is it's very critical that it can't be peeled off and put back on. And it's amazing how hard that is to achieve sometimes. People have gotten very good at taking stickers off. If you go to DEF CON, they have a whole little community set up where they give you stickers and syringes full of acetone and razor blades and brushes and Q-tips, and they teach you how to peel labels off of things. So it's gotten the skill of removing the labels and the skill of making adhesives that you cannot remove without leaving evidence is kind of this empirical raising of the bar that there's a few rounds every couple of years. And for a while, the label removers were way in the lead. Now I think it's gotten back to about even again. But there was a period of time when, I think for several years, I did not find a single label I couldn't remove. Now people are making them again that are, the big thing was a solvent that became very commonly available all of a sudden, orange oil. If anyone's ever used Goof Off or Goo Gone, the stuff's amazing. It will dissolve almost any adhesive without hurting anything else. So that changed the nature of the whole security tamper label business. At level three, you have some choices. You can embed the whole module in epoxy. You can, if it's an openable module, you can have a pick-resistant lock with a cover switch so that when you open it, the secrets get erased. Those are the two most common at level three, either embedding it in epoxy or using a lockable case. At level four, it's kind of anything goes. Since the lab is allowed to use any technique they can envision for attacking a level four module, the designs of the tamper sensors in level four modules vary all over the place, too. There have only been about six independent designs. There are only 15 or 20 level four validations that have ever been done, and if you look at them, the majority of them are just revalidations by the same company over the years as they update it. So the thing is, there have been about three or four techniques that people have used over the years, and level four stuff's really hard. Unless you have a real good reason and a really big budget, I don't recommend it.
Who did the first one?
What?
Who did the first level four?
Some guys at IBM. The operational environment. This is probably the least understood requirement, and it's probably one of the most important for most people. The operational environment of the module refers to really the OS it runs on. And so if you have the most common operational environment is a general purpose computer operating system that is modifiable. The user can change the code, update it, run patches, all that stuff. They don't have to be verified. They don't have to be checked. You can just change it. So that is a fully modifiable operational environment, and that causes all the requirements in Section 6 to come in, and you don't want any part of them. At level 1, it's not so bad. You can pretty much hand wave it all off because the module is... At level one, we're really talking about integrity and operational verification. At level two and above, that gets a lot more serious. And if you have a modifiable operational environment, there is hell to pay. At level two and above, people pretty much consider the entire software load as part of the environment. That's back to the logical environment, now matches the physical environment. Everything inside the box is considered part of the module. And you lock down your OS that it can only be changed all at once, and the update has to be signed. So that your integrity check still passes, all that sort of stuff. That's probably the safest approach to take, and certainly a requirement at the highest levels. So again, level two common network stuff, people can apply, you can apply updates that have been validated, because otherwise as soon as you patch it, it's no longer validated because it's not the same version you validated. But on the other hand, if you're patching stuff outside of the module, that's okay. But you can't change your platform. So there are, you need to go through all the requirements carefully for that. But normally, at level two and above, people use a non-modifiable operational environment. You change the whole thing when you update your code. And it's signed, and you know it's verified, and it's a new validated upgrade you put in. But that requirement is probably one of the most messy and complicated. Okay, so yeah, here, non-modifiable or modifiable, and this is really the thing you want to watch for. When I was a lab worker, I always said, do everything you can to get up from the level six requirements. Okay, key management. This talks about the entire life cycle of your keys from birth to death. How they get in, how they're brought into the module, how they may be transferred out of the module, what mechanism you use to protect them. For example, you can't export a 256-bit AES key wrapped by a 128-bit AES key. You know, your wrapping mechanisms have to be at least as strong or stronger than what you're protecting. There are requirements that are changing now for key transfer and for key export. Again, there are SP800s that you want to look at for that. Your lab will help you with those. Key management also includes random number generation, key establishment. There are key establishment mechanisms. You have to use approved ones. How key distribution, again, that's wrapping and sending things around. Key entry and output, you know, oh yeah, you have to blank the entry when people are typing things in. Or can you put a key in plain text? Must it be put in encrypted? Do you use a key loader? All of these things are things you have to consider, and then how the keys are stored, and then finally how the keys are zeroized. And so you have to go through every step of your key's life cycle, you have to know where your keys are at all times and know what condition they are in. For example, some things are like people keep the keys wrapped all the time and then only unwrap what they needed. That's good, because that way as soon as you turn the module off and RAM gets erased, you've got an encrypted blob in there and no key for it, and that can be considered protected. On the other hand, if you left the key for it in your code embedded in plain text, then you got a problem. So you have to go through this again with your lab, think it through, especially at the higher levels. You know, people use battery backup with automatic erasure if the box is opened, all these things at higher levels. At level one, it's pretty simple, you know, but you have to make sure you actually clear the key. One of the problems with optimizing compilers is that if you say, okay, I'm going to zeroize this key, so before I deallocate this memory, I write all zeros and then deallocate it, my optimizing compiler comes along and says, oh, wait, he's writing this value into this memory and then he's releasing it. Oh, I don't have to bother with the write. And lo and behold, then your key's left in memory. So these are the things you have to account for during your key management. And your lab's going to need to check these things. So these are things you have to be aware of. Okay, this is a good point for a little break. It's 11 o'clock. I know this stuff tends to be hard on the head. You can go ahead and ask. I'm sorry? You can have key management handled by another module and then transfer it over to you, but all the key transfer is going to have to be appropriate as well. Like some people have distributed key systems like TLS. So, but how that key, how you get everything still has to be approved. So the thing is, you can have key management distributed out, but it still has to meet all the requirements for security of the keys and how the keys are generated, handled, distributed, everything. All right, let's take a 10-minute break. We'll start at 10 after, and we will have you out. We'll probably go 40 minutes and stop at 10 to 12 for questions and get you to lunch on time. have seven slides with my telephone.
Okay. Well, this is good to bring practice.